So the mythology that we're looking at today, Norse mythology, is actually bookended by tragedy. It begins in war, it ends in war. Indeed, it's not merely bookended, but pretty much just shot through entirely with war. It is a violent tale, the beginning of the world, and it is a violent upheaval that ends it. In this way, human beings live between two poles of upheaval and darkness and confusion. Our lives in this story are lived out somewhere in the middle, knowing that even while peace reigns for a time, war would come again. Norse mythology is primarily an oral tradition. It's passed on from generation to generation, extending back to the Viking Age, and the Norse stories have their genesis in a period of history before their first colonization of this continent, before conquests all around Europe. These stories were written before there was anything so grand as an empire, when the Norse people were confined to their relatively inhospitable and land-starved little nations in Scandinavia. And so the worldview that I just spoke of, begun in struggle and ended in struggle, was for the most part born out of the inhospitable landscape where the stories were first told. There is not in these myths the lost paradise of other more comfortable climates. There is no verdant garden of Eden in Norse creation narratives, no equivalent of the land flowing with milk and honey or bright blossoms rising beneath the footsteps of a newborn Buddha. There is instead a tumultuous combination of ice and fire, the wrenching struggle of divine battle throes, and the earth wrought out of the stern stuff of giants. In other words, the world of Norse mythology is born out of the world of Norsemen and Norse women, people who were not insignificantly embedded in an often hostile environment, from which sustenance did not easily arise, resources were somewhat scarce, and peace among tribes and among people was by no means a given. Our stories are shaped by our lives. And in this case, it makes perfect sense that the stories of Norse legend are shaped by the lives of the people who told them. In the beginning, the gods fight the giants, and the evil giant Ymir's carcass is the very stuff of life itself. From an evil thing, a broken and perhaps sinful thing, all life begins. And from a violent upheaval, everything that we know, even beauty, arises. Flesh is earth, bones are mountains, blood becomes water, and the dome of a skull is the wide arc of the heavens. Out of death comes life, and on toward death it proceeds, a stark reminder of the fate which none of the original tellers of these tales, and none of us, can possibly escape. UU minister Forrest Church often said that religion is the human response to the dual realities of being alive and having to die. Sometimes it serves to shield us from those realities, placing heavenly paradise on the other end of our fear and hoping beyond hope that the fear goes away. And sometimes religion just holds before our eyes the stark reality that we must face and doesn't blink until we see it. This certainly is the case with this particular Norse myth. It stares down the darkness without bothering to wish it away, firmly acknowledging the unavoidable. Given those stark realities, it almost goes without saying that these folks had an acute understanding of fate, of inevitability. In fact, the story of creation is told in the only written account of their epic legends, the Edda, in conjunction with the story of destruction. As their narrative goes, the beginning is followed almost immediately by the end, and the in-between is all that history can tell. There is, for Norse people, like for many cultures, a parallel narrative of Armageddon that runs alongside the story of creation. Everything that is, everything that has been made, everything we love and we know now lives in the context of its eventual end. In Norse mythology, Ragnarok, a series of major calamities often defined as the doom of the gods, is the final battle where it all comes to a showdown and the earth is consumed by fire and flood and blah and blah. You all know these Armageddon ideas. In this narrative, finally, the frost giants come at last to defeat the gods. The gods lose, and the death of the gods signals the ends of the age. In one particular poem inside the Edda, a prophetess relates to the god Odin what human beings will be like in the end when the final war comes to pass. She says, "Brothers will fight and kill each other. Sisters' children will defile kinship. It is harsh in the world, an axe age, a sword age. Shields are riven, a wind age, a wolf age. Before the world goes headlong, no man will have mercy on another." In this season and in this time, when our world and our pop culture are so full of stories of Armageddon, of the end, of death and destruction, it is hard to ignore the fact that these stories told so long ago are not that different than narratives that fill the movie theaters today. The creation and destruction of the world are paired tales. The world begun in warfare and ended in violence, with life in between. It's a story even we tell, whether we like to admit it or not. A story we must find a way to make meaning out of, or else ignore entirely. Perhaps we would like to think that such an outlook, a bleak moral landscape where warfare is inevitable and life only comes from death, is the sort of tales only told by ancient Vikings wearing breastplates and big horned helmets. Perhaps we would like to think that we don't tell such stories ourselves, that our narrative, the story we tell, is a tale of human progress. A story about how humankind is moving closer and closer year by year to wisdom, to peacefulness, to compassion, moving always away from the dark days and toward the lighter days, beyond the horizon, where nation shall not lift up sword against nation, and war shall be no more. But we do not, after all, live in the most hospitable of times. 2009 was on many counts not the best of years. Ours is a landscape where sustenance is not guaranteed for everyone, where peaceful coexistence is by no means a given, and an era when many of our young children have always been citizens of a nation at war. Even with the optimism of a new year, when 2010 beckons as a brighter time than 2009, we still find ourselves confronted with the world that is not just a gentle place which is kind to us. And we are called, even when it is hard, to adjust our ideals and our expectations to meet the world we live in, not just the one we imagine. I heard a report on National Public Radio recently where reporters went around the streets of New York City and they asked people simply if they believed it is possible for human beings to live life entirely without war. What followed was a litany of no's in every tone, timbre, and accent of the English language. Seldom have I heard something so difficult to listen to. Some were sorrowful no's. Some sounded a little bit angry. Others were merely declarative, as if the answer was obvious and the truth was self-evident. Will we ever live without war? Is peaceful coexistence of the sort we spend our holiday season dreaming about even possible? The ancient Norsemen would say no. In war it is begun, they said, and in war it will be ended. Will we ever live without war? Is peaceful coexistence even possible? No, says the man on the street in New York City. No, says the woman dropping her kids off at daycare. No, says the president, the cabinet, the generals, and parents of soldiers who die for their country. No, we say. And we are not, after all, so far off from the Norse canon of inevitable creation and inevitable destruction, after all. It was Thomas Jefferson, himself a Unitarian, who said a line that I have been struggling with for years and patently do not agree with. The tree of liberty, he said, must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. The inevitability of darkness, of bloodshed and war, of struggle and suffering, pervades our psyche because we cannot look away from it, because it is very real among us, even at the turning of the new year. Some would say that not only are warfare and human destruction inevitable, but necessary. And with grief, I think I have come to cede inevitable, but I won't cede necessary. If only because I think ideals change us, because even an impossible dream is worth dreaming, because living in the shadow of inevitable destruction instead of basking in the slimmest chance of a more peaceful world creates us in the image of that story. And it's a story I don't want to live out. After all, the ancient Norsemen were shaped by their mythology, even as their mythology was shaped by their experience. Valhalla, which you might have heard of, the great kingdom of the gods, was reserved not for the kindest and gentlest of souls, but for the people who died in battle, which was, of course, the greatest honor a warrior could attain. To say that war is necessary, that it must happen in order for us to function as human societies, is frankly too much for me to bear. And so I lay over top of my rationalism a tiny little sliver of idealism. Not idiocy and hopefully not naivete, but carefully crafted idealism that guides me through the hard night in the hope that darkness might not really last forever. And the truth is that even in the darkest creation story I could find, which is this one, it doesn't really end with the destruction of everything. Though much less famous and much less retold than the stories of Ragnarok and the doom of the gods, there is a tiny little piece of the Icelandic Edda which says that in the end, after the great war, there will be a corner of the world that remains new and fertile even after the burning times. There will be a few survivors, and they will meet on that last green patch of hope and see, of all things, the tale tells, an eagle flying free over a waterfall in the shadow of a mountain, and life will begin again. Life begins, following always hot on the heels of death. And in the very last part of the Icelandic Edda, the fields grow underneath the feet of those last bedraggled people without their needing even to be sown. Even for a culture which clothed its entire mythology in warfare, there is a tiny glimmer of hope. Idealism isn't entirely dead. And even if war is inevitable, even if you ask 10 million persons on the street, will it ever be possible to live without war, and every last one of them said, no, even so, it's not the end of the story, but a sort of tortured new beginning. If, in fact, religion is the dual response of being alive and having to die, it should pull us between the poles of denial and darkness, help us find a way to be where idealism can thrive, but uninformed optimism can be deepened into heartfelt hope. For some reason, this week, as thinking about these creation myths, I have continually come back to an image from maybe a decade ago in my life of a prairie fire that I helped set back in the fertile plains of Illinois. You see, the prairies depend on fire to tear through regularly and clear away all the old dry grasses. They leave these fertile, charred embers behind them, from which the surviving seeds fall and the earth rises up again, and it gives birth to a whole new prairie every year. And of course, all over the prairie, you know what's happened. Huge tracts of land across which the fires once raged have broken up, subdivided into towns, into lawns, into parking lots, and the fires can't burn anymore. People have chosen to pretend that the burning never needed to happen at all, and in so doing, they've almost killed their natural environment. And so my friends and I, on a cold Saturday morning those years back, accompanied by a fire marshal, of course, started a prairie fire on the patch of grassland abutting our church. We watched it burn, we guided its path, we fanned the flames that we had been taught inherently to fear, and the next spring the wildflowers blossomed, and we knew we had had some small part in it, because we had not been afraid to be there when it burned. Now, I don't think that war always, or even often, gives rise to new life. War is usually just war. And in that way, I can't relate to Icelandic creation myths at all. I can't focus on the end of times or the inevitable doom of all mankind or what's going to happen in 2012. It's a story that shapes us in ways we simply do not need to be shaped. But I can say that the endings of old things, even when they are traumatic, can be the beginnings of something breathtakingly new. I can say that our very brokenness is often what gives us the power to be born again, and that we need not ignore the darkness that faces us, but transform it into light. In the Icelandic Edda, they wrote of an axe age, a sword age, a wind age, a wolf age. That is how the Great War is described. And to me these days it sounds entirely too familiar. But it doesn't really end there. And so even if it is only my idealism speaking, even if it is only the hopefulness of a new year, may the axe age give rise to an age of renewed aspirations. May the swords indeed become plowshares. May the great winds cease to blow, if only long enough to admire the wildflowers. And may the teeth of the wolf bear down no more. In this new year, all of our dark times may just be the beginning of a season of hope. We need not look away from the darkness, but neither can we cease trying always to do what we must to transform the darkness into light. May it be so, and Amen.